This show is brought to you by our show sponsor, BetterHelp Online Therapy. It goes without saying, the only way to get help is to ask for it. Don't struggle alone. BetterHelp is a customized online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist, so you don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. It's much more affordable than in-person therapy, and you can start communicating with your therapist in under 48 hours. Join the millions of people who are seeing what therapy is really about. It's always a good time to invest in yourself because you are your greatest asset. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp, and 21 and over listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/holly. That's BetterHelp.com/holly. Hello and welcome back to 21 and over. I'm very happy to be back this week and super excited for today's guest. He's a world-renowned tattoo artist, and he will be talking to myself and Tally about how he got to where he is today and his own mental health journey. But first, as always, it's time for a check-in. Hello, Tally. How are you today?
Hey, good to be back. How has your week been, Holz? What are your highs and lows?
Firstly, I'm excited that we're back in person.
Yeah, me too. Feels good to be back.
It's been a good week. Let's start with the high. The high is actually Miles did two more tattoos on me, and he's actually the only person who has given me a tattoo so far. And these ones have a lot of meaning behind them, and I was super grateful that he said he would do them. So I'm very happy with those.
Yeah, they're amazing. I know the listeners can't see them, but they're very cool.
And then the low, I would say some people from my past have kind of tried to come back into my life, and as they had said, they see that I'm moving up in the world and they kind of want to become friends again. And if I'm honest, it made me feel pretty shit, kind of feeling pretty used, and it was so unexpected.
Yeah.
I was caught by surprise, and yeah, just wasn't a good kind of like part of the week.
Well, I guess it was probably quite triggering and reminded you a lot of what you've left behind, basically.
Yeah, it definitely did. And I think, as with anything, I was kind of on edge for a few days afterwards.
Yeah, of course.
And still am. But how about you? How has your week been?
My high and low are probably the same, in that the high is that I am out of quarantine and able to kind of go back into the world and you know, go out for dinner and go to the gym and whatever. But the low is that I'm out of quarantine.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when my poor partner tested positive for COVID, I thought I was in such a bad mood. You know, it's one of those things that you can't be cross with that person for catching COVID. Bless him. And I was really snappy, very, you know, made it all about me. But actually we had, you know, 10 days together, and he wasn't actually well, but it's so nice. You forget again, you know, it's so quick. We've been in lockdown for a year, and then you come out and you forget that you've just had that year. And actually to be able to go back in for 10 days, it was really kind of quiet and calm. And I didn't feel guilty about sitting on the sofa, and I didn't feel like I had to go and do a million one things. So that, you know, it was sad to leave that, you know, and I was like, oh my God, I can't believe it. It just shows me how, you know, just need to take one day at a time and not project and think that something's going to be awful. Because I actually had, it was a very lovely 10 days. So that's also high is the same as my low.
Well, I'm sure it's also showed you, you know, sometimes just hit pause for a little bit and take a break.
Big time. I find it very difficult to do that, to just chill. And I'm very lucky that my partner's very encouraging about just, you know, just take a break. But I find it difficult because I'm always sort of, you know, it's a guilt, right? It's a guilt of not doing enough.
I'm feeling like you should be doing a million.
Especially if the whole world's doing something, or everyone's running around, and you know, you compare yourself and all sorts of things. So, but anyway, it's a good reminder to just take stock sometimes.
Of course. Well, speaking of Miles, I'm very excited to talk to him. Now, today, I'm very excited for our guest. He's an incredibly successful tattoo artist and also a friend of mine. Please welcome Miles Langford.
Hey, what's up?
Hi, Miles. How are you?
I'm excited to be here.
Excited.
I'm just worried I'm going to talk too much, but
well, it's a good thing it's a podcast. You can talk as much as you like.
It's going to be a long one.
So how have you been handling the last year?
Yeah, the last year, I think it's had a, you know, for all of us, it's had our ups and downs. I often had to remind myself that I had hot water and a roof over my head, and that I could order what I wanted off Deliveroo when I wanted, and that was enough. For me, I'm a very driven, work-focused person. So that was quite frustrating period of time, you know. So there was often moments where I had to sort of look back and look what I had sort of established and achieved rather than look at what I haven't yet done. And I think that played on my mind a fair bit. It was tough. There was definitely days where, you know, I live alone, but like, thank God for I got my two dogs, but I live alone. And so there was definitely days where there was a lot of time to think. And luckily they had the football still on. So every day it was quite weird. Every day I'd be like, right, if you can just get to 6 p.m. or 5:30, like Aston Villa Leeds or something is on, you know, that I wouldn't necessarily watch, but it was like, I just had to make markers through the day to like get me through the day, you know? And it's like, it was tough. There was, and I think it sort of culminated in Christmas time. I'm a very family orientated person, similar to yourself. And I think when Christmas was coming, I was all good. I was like, yeah, it's fine. Christmas is fine. It's all good. And then like, I think 2 days before Christmas, I started running like twice a day. And then Christmas Eve ran at like 10 p.m. and Christmas morning got up and ran. I had to like, I was just like, it really like hit me hard. Suddenly I felt very, very like alone. And that was pretty tough. You know, I managed to escape on Christmas Day. I ended up getting on a flight and getting out of town and ended up going and tattooing in Dubai for 6 weeks. So I got away from it all. Oh, wow. But yeah, it was a rough process, you know. Just had to like count our blessings and count the health and what you did have, I think.
Other than, you know, having the football on every day, what did you find was useful in terms of creating a routine? I think we've talked a lot about routine and how that's really important when you've got nothing on. Mm-hmm. And how did you kind of, living on your own, you mentioned you have dogs.
Yeah.
How did you kind of create a routine for yourself?
That was tough. Mm. I struggled with that. My brain's so erratic that it's just very hard to like pin me down to like a, you know, my close friends and family and partner will tell you it's hard because I'm just all over the place. You know, I'm like, I'm very disciplined with like a lot of stuff, but like there was days I wouldn't get out of bed till 1:30 in the afternoon. Mm. And I normally wake up at like 7-8 a.m. and I just couldn't move. You know, like I occasionally get hit with the depression or whatever it was that day. But it was like, you know, there was multiple times I think I had a notepad out and was like, all right, 9 till 10, you watch Bloomberg, 10 to 11, watch this thing about how to trade, like 11 till 12, you're going to make your, and I just couldn't commit to it. So yeah. I'm a big advocate and a big fan of routine and know how much it works for so many people, but yeah, I struggle with it.
Of course, I think we all did. I definitely did. I struggled having nothing to do and there wasn't even like a journey to work to kind of wind down for the day at the end of the day. That was a very difficult thing that I struggled with.
Yeah, that journey home from work is an important one. Mm. I took it for granted up until recently. And everyone used to say, because I live in sort of southwest London, and everyone sort of said, oh, why'd you have like such a long drive to and from work? And then I started to appreciate that it was half an hour to wind down. You know, like in the car, as much as driving in London is stressful for some people, and it is stressful. But I used to live very close to my business, and I found I was home, and I was still at work mentally. I was still like having that debate or that thought. Like I hadn't switched off, and I found that was quite. I found that to be quite negative in the end. You know, to be living so close in such a close proximity obviously had its positives when the shit hit the fan. You know, you could literally just get there. But I feel like, yeah, it was actually almost like a bit of a burden just to be so accessible and to be so close to the business, you know. It was, so now I actually really appreciate like breaking up the day and like the way to work. I predominantly phone Abby, who's like sort of my right-hand person who helps me out with a lot of stuff. I normally phone her and we digest what's going on, think about what we've got coming up, or debrief about the night before. Or yeah, I use that time, and I find by the time I get to work or by the time I'm home, I'm in the correct headspace one way or the other.
If you don't mind, I'd love to go back to sort of the beginning and ask you, you know, what your childhood was like and if you were kind of always into art.
My childhood, as I think anyone's childhood, I think it was interesting. I was brought up in a loving household. With two parents around, grandparents, sister. Like any family, we had our traumas and our ups and downs. And I would say it was a fun, slightly volatile, interesting upbringing. And the fact that I wouldn't say I was ready to conform to rules and regulations for a long time when I was younger. And I think mom and dad tried their very best to help nurture what I had, whether it be football or art or anything that wasn't geography, maths, science, basically anything that wasn't academic. Mm. You know, like as I've grown older, I've learned to love literature and I like to try and think of myself as quite a literate person. However, not much sunk in school. You know, it was very hard for me. I think there was a turning point, and I think I was around 12 or 13 when my mom turned around to me and said, I know you're not going to do a quote unquote normal job, and I know you're not going to have a normal life, but I believe you're going to be something, and I believe you're going to do something with your life, and I've just got to put my trust in something that you're going to be okay. And I think to hear that at such a young age, and for that to have been acknowledged at such a young age, was very impactful. It's something that I had a long conversation with her just recently about it. But to have the self-belief and to have the belief from the two people that I looked up to the most, you know, mom and dad, at a young age, was like, I think just that one line has just stuck with me forever. Mm. And it was, I don't know if my mom probably, like, you know, just said it off the, I don't know if she thought about it for hours before she said it or she just said it. But to hear a lot growing up, you're not going to be anything, or like, you're not going to amount to nothing, you know, like, why do you want to, like, I remember we'd go and play football at school and I'd draw on my hands with Sharpies and like on my arms, you know, like I always wanted to have tattoos. And I think we'd go and play other schools at football and they would be like, oh, you look like a weird. And then I'll just score a hat trick and be like, yeah, shut up. You know, like I was just like, I always just wanted to do things my way. And I've always thought outside the box. But I think, yeah, going back to the childhood thing, I was very, very lucky in the fact that mum and dad would like have conversations with the school and tell them that if he's going to be silent in class because he's drawing on his school books and stuff, just let him draw. And if he wants to leave the lesson to go to art block, just let him do it, because if he doesn't want to be, he's not going to take anything in. You know, even to this day now, like I was just recently away and my girlfriend was like, I bought a book for you to read on holiday. And I was like, oh God, a book. Like, and I love learning. No, I really, really love learning, but I was like, oh, a book. And I think she's going to kill me because I can't, it's called As I Lay Dying, and it's written by a famous author, but it's written in not very, I want to say practical or very like sensible English. It's written like maybe further ahead than I am with it. And it was, she was like, just read, just switch off and just read. And I actually really enjoy it, but I can't take any information in. Mm-hmm. So it's like I can read Neil Young's autobiography and be passionate Neil Young fan. I can't. I can read chapter after chapter, sit there and take in every word, read it. And I could be, someone be like, "Well, have you just read?" I'll be like, "No, I don't."
Yeah, I can relate to that.
So then in school they're like, "That are you stupid? Like, just read the science book." And I'm like, "Yeah, but if I'm sitting there drawing, which is the ironic part, if I'm sat there drawing, and Holly or yourself told me a story, I could probably tell you it word for word."
Wow.
So it's for what I believe is called cognitive learning. Mm. So it's where you can like distract yourself. It's like I shake one of my legs quite often and people are like, oh, like, you know, and I'm like, no, I'm trying to keep my brain switched on. So if my body's doing something, it helps me to stay engaged. Mm. So, but in school, this is like 17, 18 years ago, that wasn't so understood or that wasn't so recognized. You know, it was just like someone's talking at me and I'm just sitting there like that. I can hear you. And I can understand you, but I can't remember it. Mm. Whereas my sister was an A-star student, read a book and just rewrite the book. You know, just like that was it, A-star. And I'm there like that. I remember like, and I don't even know if I've ever told him, but I remember in my English GCSE, and I think I only got about 6 GCSEs, but I think in my English GCSEs, I think the question for the writing question was something like, what do you want to achieve? Or what? And I just said, you know what, like, excuse my French, I didn't write this, but I just said, fuck it. I just wrote from my heart and wrote about how I just want to make my dad proud.
Mm.
And I just wrote, like, honestly, like, the, like, pages of this stuff. No punctuation or no probably correct grammar, but I just wrote from the heart and just, you know, told whoever read it a story about how I just was really determined just to have my old man be proud of me, you know? So these are all things that kind of stood out from my childhood that I don't necessarily think it was a normal upbringing. I think my mom and dad had a hard time with me and my sister for different reasons, But, you know, I'm very close with those guys. And yeah, I'm blessed to be here. And I'm blessed that they let me spread my wings at 16. And they backed me to go to New York when I was 20, 21. And we've had an amazing relationship ever since.
I think that's so amazing how your parents embraced your creativeness, because too much in school, I mean, even when I was at school, I was labeled the creative one because I wasn't academic. And I'm still not. But as you said, I love learning. I just can't do it the conventional way where you read a book and then get tested on it. That's not for me. And way too early on were my parents told, you know, she's the creative one, and kind of, you know, we've got to find other ways to make her learn things. And it doesn't work for everyone.
Yeah. There's no right or wrong way to do it. You know, if you can get to the end result, you know, I think that's the main thing. And I think that's what I struggled with being younger, was that I would get to the end result and someone was telling me it was the wrong way, you've got there. And I just said it shouldn't matter because I got there, you know. And for me, it was having these standoffs with teachers or, you know, adults at the time, you know, these people who I looked at as far older, who are probably only my age, but like they just, you know, they couldn't understand where I was coming from. And it does make it hard. I think for my whole life, I just gravitated towards finishing school to play football, or finishing work to like meet up with my friends, or to finish tattooing to go to the bar. You know, it was always like, I just wanted to like finish and do my own thing. So yeah, it's been an interesting one.
So when did you get your first tattoo?
So we were all hanging out, BMXing together, in the local skate parks and stuff. And we figured out if we did use a needle and thread and some Indian ink, that we could permanently mark each other's skin. So I have a tattoo on the top of my right thigh that says BMX. And it's been there since I was about 15 years old, I think. And then my second one, I remember I was staying with my grandma, my nan, and I told her I was just staying in the local with one of the local lads. And I remember bunking, or like we call it bunking, I don't know what it's called now, skipping or jumping a train. And I went all the way to Exeter to meet some girl off of MySpace. And, you know, we'd only ever spoke on MySpace. You know, we had 5 pictures of each other. You couldn't send each other pictures or webcam or none of that stuff. So I just went and met her. And, you know, I think she had said on the first, she was like, I think I love you, before we'd even met, you know. It was just so young and like naive. And I went up there to Exeter and I was like, I'm going to get tattooed. So I just went into some shit tattoo shop and got a diamond on my leg. It was probably like 40 quid. You know, I couldn't have looked older than 15. And so that was that. And then fast forward till I was 17 and yeah, got most of my right leg from just below my knee to my toes tattooed. And that was, mum and dad gave their blessing on that because it wasn't on my arm. They were like, just do it on your leg. So they've always been like, since I was about 11, I seen tattoos when I was about 11 in Kerrang magazine. And it was a rock and roll magazine back in the day. And it was, funnily enough, I told you guys I was going to waffle, but there was funny enough, there was a, the singer of Linkin Park has flames tattooed on his arm. He sadly passed away now, but he had flames from his wrist to his elbow. And that was what first got my attention for tattoos. And I always used to draw the flames on, going back to the school days, you draw the flames on. And then fast forward to when I was living in Hermosa Beach in California, I was in a tattoo shop and working with an older guy. And he turned around, same sort of question. Oh, what got you into tattooing? I said, oh, I was 11, young, Chester for Linkin Park. I said, you're going to laugh. And he laughed, you know, he laughed about the story. And I was like, yeah, why are you laughing so much, you know? And he was like, they're from Hermosa Beach. I did those tattoos.
No, I knew you were going to say that. I can't believe it.
Yeah, so I was working with the guy. Like, that's some weird synchronicity, the way the world works. You know, that's mad. Yeah. I was just in the room. And I
got goosebumps.
Having that conversation never come up, I could have never known. That was a trip. That was a crazy, crazy trip to be like, to how it's all gone full circle, to be in that room in a small beach town in California, to be working alongside someone who did the thing that got me into my craft, that's now provided me with such a beautiful and like blessed life. I'm forever grateful. Forever grateful.
Crazy. So who taught you most of the skills that you use today?
I've got a long list of people to probably thank for this, but I'll always say my dad got me into art and he could paint. And he used to do watercolor paintings. So I'd always say that was a slight inspiration. But when it comes down to hardcore tattooing, I have a friend. It's another little story. So I have a friend called, his name is Matthew, but everyone knows him as Matt, and he's been tattooing for a little while. And so when I was 22, I was living in New York, and my ex-partner was like, on my case, you need to get another job. You can't just be modeling. You can't just be smoking weed. You need to like do more with your life. And I was having my torso tattooed at the time. And I said, oh, I really want to be a tattooer. You know, I've wanted to be a tattooer since 11 years old. I really want to do it. And she kind of gives it the old eye roll and like, of course you do. You know, this is going to last 2 months. And like, you know, what's the next thing, you know? And anyway, so I've emailed Math, right? I've emailed Math and I've gone, hey man, like, can you please help me out trying to get an apprenticeship? You know, like I really want to be a tattooer. You know, I've known you since I was 18. Like, I don't really know where else to turn. And he was like, oh, if you're serious, then fly to England and prove it to me. So I was like, okay. Got on a plane from New York, come to London, understudied him for like a week or two. You know, I've been there, done that. And he was like, all right, go back to New York and I'll sort something out. So anyway, I've gone back to New York and I'm at a different tattoo shop just hanging out, and I get a call, go meet these people now at this tattoo shop down the road, 121 Essex Road in New York in the Lower East Side. So I've gone over there, walked in and like, hey, I'm here to like meet about the apprenticeship. They like that. Oh, there's a toilet full of boxes, start breaking them down. And I've just come off set from like a Hugo Boss campaign or something. You know what I mean? Like, and now I'm like cleaning toilets, and it's like, I'm like, well, it's very, very humbling. But long story short, I've done that. I've got the apprenticeship in the Lower East Side, and fast forward to now, the first person who works for me now, and the person who's worked there the longest since I've had my shop is Math. So like, as soon as I had a shop, the first person I offered a job to was him, and I always felt indebted to him. So I feel even now, like I would say now, he would say the favor's paid off, and we're equal. But you know, I always had that in my head that I was going to cut, that one day when I had a shop, I'd give him a job to you know, just to complete that circle. And now he's been working for me for a little while, and that's one of the most rewarding things I've had happen to me since I've been a business owner, is like to be able to have him like upgrade his lifestyle and to provide more for his son, just from an idea that sort of I came up with, has been a very rewarding feeling. You know,
so you opened London Social Tattoo 2 years ago, and I was wondering what inspired you to do that. Obviously you've touched on some things, but has this always been a dream?
I just thought I could do it better than anyone else was doing it.
That's a very good answer.
The thing with the tattoo industry is, and I got no problem saying it, is a lot of tattoo shops and a lot of tattooers want to be cool to other tattooers. So a lot of what they do, they base their marketing on other tattooers. They go to conventions to get their ego stroked. They make their like, I'm doing this massive tattoo, look at me. You know, it's very like tattooer focused as a vocation. You know, they want to be accepted by other tattooers, right? So all I did was like, you know what? I'm going to make it really, really fucking accessible for people to come and get small tattoos. And I'm going to monopolize what used to be a walk-in tattoo. So like a word or like an LDN on a wrist or like a little love heart. I'm going to monopolize these, make it accessible for people to see that this is available at a space, which is all white and clean. Sam Smith's music playing, you know, like all like the, like the fun things, you know, like all the nice things that like I made a space that's friendly for like 18 to 81 year olds throughout the whole, like the whole of London and outside, that they could come in and be welcomed, and they weren't greeted by a guy on the front desk with like solid black tattoo arms and like scary dude with heavy metal. It was like, why don't you go after the clientele? So other tattooers walk in the shop and be like, this isn't very tattoo-y. And I'm like, that, yeah, but I'm off in my Range Rover on the way home. I don't care. Like, I don't care. You know what I mean? Like I didn't do this to appease other tattooers, because in my head, I have Mark Mahoney and Bob Roberts and the old school guys in tattooing across the globe. They all back me because I've done my time and I've worked under them. So I've got the blessings of the people that I think count. So I'm not bothered if someone in their 30s or their 40s thinks I'm like changing the game. I wanted to build a successful business. And now we've got shop three, you know, it's like changing the way people perceive tattooing and keeping up with the times. You know, that was like, tattooing's kind of in the dark ages. You know, there's no HR. You know, my best friend's the HR of this industry now. You know, like he goes and puts his foot down. He's like, nah, you ain't doing this. That's what inspired me. I also had a crazy network of people within the public eye that I'd known for the last sort of eight years at that point. And I had all these friends and all these different people I knew who were successful in their own right. And I never asked anything of any of these people. You know, they've always come to me and asked me to get tattooed. So I was like, why the fuck am I going to take this somewhere else when I can just put it under my own roof and people can eat off the back of it? So that's what's happened. You know, tattoo more and more people and more people are getting fed and more of my friends are like coming and sitting at the table. And it's a very good feeling most of the time. There's some pressure and some stress sometimes, but it's like for the most part, it's good, you know, it's like rewarding.
I will say though, because I mean, you've so far done all my tattoos, all three of them. And I was quite scared to go into a tattoo shop because they can be quite daunting places. Because when you think of them, you think of these big guys on the front desk with like heavily covered. But, you know, yours was very welcoming. You lit a candle.
It's making me want to go. And I've never, I've been too scared. I've been way too scared. It's much worse. And now I'm like, oh, I want to go see Sam Smith's music playing in a nice white tattoo place.
You just have to put up with my singing along.
Even better.
That was the whole concept behind the space was to, have a friendly, welcoming space. And, you know, if you ever get really bored and you look at the Google reviews, a lot of the time people say that they felt like they were part of a family when they came into the space and they felt welcomed. And I said, you know, one of the few rules we have is if you're telling jokes and telling stories within the space, you know, it's got to be, the clientele has got to be included. It's got to be very inclusive. You can't all be laughing and people not know why. You know, I don't want anyone to ever feel uncomfortable in this space. You know, I said, as big or as small as a tattoo, you got to make it with love. And you got to make sure the people are welcome. And you got to make sure they're like, from the second they arrive to the second they leave to the thank you email that gets sent at the end of the day, the whole thing is done like very professionally.
Yeah.
I like some materialistic stuff and I like high fashion and I like nice watches and stuff. So I try to take the best bits of how the service industry is and kind of bring that into a tattoo shop. And I remind everyone that like, there's multiple people to get tattooed from. And I always say still at the end of every tattoo, thanks for getting tattooed by me. And I think a lot of people just get caught up in their Instagram followers or their blue tick or their hype and they just go, actually, there's not many tattooers that have verified. But there's a lot of people who get caught up in the followers and the thing and then they take it for granted. And, you know, I think there's people who come and get tattooed by me now who are kind of like fans sometimes and they're like so grateful. And I'm always like, oh, but thanks for choosing me. And they're like, no, I wouldn't have anyone else do it. But I'm like, yeah, but you had options, you know, and it's reminding yourself that not to get caught up in the hype or to get caught up in your own hysteria. You got to remind yourself. I think that's where so many people nowadays go wrong because they don't ground themselves and they don't like, you know, even today, I don't need to go to work today and tattoo. You know, it's my day off. I've got a business plan to finish. I've got other things to do. You know, like I could have, you know, I woke up with my missus, could have just chilled, you know, but my clientele, again, someone that like he's on TV, blah, blah, blah. He's got a short time frame window and it's like, I got to lead from the front, so I got to keep pushing. You know, I got to keep working hard. You know, I can't sit back on my laurels now just because the shop's busy and that we got great tattooers. I got to be at the forefront and keep leading.
You were talking though, you obviously touching on the fact that there's pressure and then there's stress. And actually, I wonder, talking about that, how mental health affects you and how it actually affects your work, or does it affect your work?
This show is brought to you by our show sponsor, BetterHelp Online Therapy. Take it from me, going to therapy is cool. It doesn't have to be in-person therapy either. It can be at home, on the computer, in the comfort of your own bed, and in your pajamas. BetterHelp will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist. You can start communicating in under 48 hours. It's not a crisis line. It's not self-help. It is professional counseling done securely online. There is a broad range of expertise available, which may not be locally available in many areas. The service is available for clients worldwide. You can log into your account anytime and send a message to your counselor. You'll get timely and thoughtful responses, plus you can schedule weekly video or phone sessions, so you won't ever have to sit in an uncomfortable waiting room as with traditional therapy. BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, so they make it easy and free to change counselors if needed. It's more affordable than traditional offline counseling and financial aid is available. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp and 21 and over listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/holly. That's BetterHelp therapyhub.com/holly.
I was saying to someone the other day, I ended up learning how to tattoo through panic attacks.
Wow.
Yeah, I ended up learning how to disguise it and how to just get on with it to the point that I can actually, like, it'll take a lot for me now to have to stop tattooing. Like, it was a very significant, maybe that's the wrong word, but it's something that stands out for me. And I was tattooing, and the client would never have known, I don't think. But I remember I was tattooing something, and it was a couple of weeks after lockdown had been lifted and the shop had flooded and my old assistant had fucked up, and like there was a 40 grand bill that was potentially hitting me, and like there was just a load of shit that just hit the fan at one time. Like, and I remember it all kind of, you know, all kind of culminating, and then I was sat there and I was just, I could feel myself having a panic attack, and I just was just like, oh, just fuck it, I'm just going to just get on with it. And I just tattooed through it. And I was just like, I know I'm not going to die. So I just got on with it. You know, and it was like, that's not right, man. That's not like, you know, that's not cool. Yeah. You know, that's not what you should be doing. No. And I remember back in LA years ago, I remember we were smoking weed, and my old boss hit me with the wrong strain of weed. And it just hit me like this anxiety went through the roof. And I remember we were in this beautiful like air conditioned tattoo shop, and I was tattooing someone's chest. And I remember being over the top of this guy, and just like, it was like the Mission Impossible scene where the sweat just drew like off me, like onto the client. And like my client was just like, oh, you okay? He's like, do you need to take a break? And I was like, yeah, yeah, I just need a break. And I had to go outside, and it was just like, so yeah, there has been occasions where the anxiety and stuff has come into play during the tattoos. But Ed Hardy once said, tattooing is the closest thing you'll find to a witch doctor, because you get in so into your own headspace when you're doing it, you can kind of go off on so many different journeys whilst you're tattooing. Because once you've been doing it for a while, it's I don't want to say autopilot, because I don't want to disrespect the craft. But like for me nowadays, I know how a tattoo is going to come out for the most part. I know how it's going to look when I've finished it. So it's just a matter of just going through the motions. Mm. And yeah, you can go off into these like, I don't even know where you go. You just go so far removed from being in the physical room, you know?
You're so present, right? You're in a state of flow, basically. Mm, you're completely focused.
It's like when you drive and exactly, you just arrive. Yeah. It's just like, it's kind of like that. But then I think sometimes people are talking to me and they kind of feel it that I'm not there. But as far as the stress and trying to manage that and the depression and stuff, yeah, it's hard. It's hard. I think I was like in the bath recently, and I don't know if everyone does this, but my missus sits on the top of the toilet and I sit in the bath and we talk, you know, that's our kind of one of our things. And I think we've had some of our deepest conversations in that situation. Mm. But I was sitting there and I was trying to break it down, just trying to understand why I was so stressed and so like, you know, uptight and stuff. And I think I realized after a while that on top of having the shop and the pressures of getting every multiple mouths fed and all that sort of stuff, it was that like with where I've got to now with my work, subconsciously, I don't even think about it, but subconsciously the pressure is so high to do a good tattoo every day, to perform every day, because people are coming and spending a lot of money to get tattooed. And I don't even think about it. But then I was trying to explain to my missus is that like, you're not just putting me in like a really tranquil, beautiful room like we're sat in now and just being at peace. I'm sat in there and I've got a third of my brain going, creative hat, do a sick tattoo, be a creative. I've got a third of my brain going, has this back end of the stuff been done? And what's the VAT bill going to be? And have you done this? Have you done that? Like, what's going on? And then the other half, third of me is just like trying to rein in my ADD. You know what I mean? So it's like people are like that, right, go and perform to the top of your ability. But whilst you've got people coming in going, hey, this person's running late. Like, hey, my client, like, what do you think of this? Should I mark it? How do you want to do this? Like this, like, what's going on with the other shop? Like, where's Pierce? Like, what? And you're like this. Okay, but let me do a really fucking sick tattoo at the same time. And then what people don't see, because that's not what we show online, is they don't see some days I come home and have to lay flat out on my wooden floor on my back, just calm, just lay down and let the dogs jump all over me and can't move. Because my brain's so overworked and overstressed, they don't see that. They just see like the Instagram. As much as I don't post loads, but they see like some of the trips, or they see you on the watch or the car. Do you know what I mean? It's like they just like, I just get people coming, oh, you're killing it. Life looks so good. And I'm like, yeah, it does look good and it is good, but there's a lot of BTS, you know, BTS stroke BS that you don't see, you know. And that's when it's tough, you know, waking up with a hard bout of depression and having to get out of the house. and not understanding why you're depressed. That's the hardest part for me, is that I wake up in a beautiful city with my beautiful girlfriend, with beautiful stuff around me, and everything I nearly wanted to ever have materialistically, I've got, and I wake up so fucking sad, and I can't put my finger on why. And it's like, that is what I struggle with more than anything else. The worst bit is that you feel like you should be happy. That's when it kills you, because you're like, I should be happy because so many people would kill to have what I have, and I'm not happy, and that makes me feel guilty. But what I do find is that I'm very lucky that I'm confident enough to verbalize it. And I feel like I'm one of the few people in my circle who goes, you know what? I'm depressed today. And I own it. I just tell people. I'll go, I'm having bad anxiety today. People are like, oh, and I'm like, if I don't talk about it, I'm going to suffer in silence. So I express it. And I find most of the time expressing it and conversing over dinners or conversing over lunches or talking to my clients, most people are understanding and sympathetic to you. Everyone asks how they can help and knows obviously no one can do anything to help, but just talking about it sometimes relieves it. And I found that's the biggest tool in my armors, or one of the biggest tools, is to verbalize it. Because I think when you don't, it just eats away at you, man. It's the hardest part. It's just the suffering in silence. And I just can't do it. And I think, if there's people that I like, or there's people like me, you know, 6 foot plus, covered in tattoos, bigger blokes, if we can't own it and own up to it, how's the next person, how's the next one going to do it? Mm. So I think if I can go up and own it, then hopefully with the small platform that I have, hopefully someone else will see that, and someone else will, like, hopefully that will help their day and help them take control of it the next time. And we can understand that it's not, you're not just you. It's not just going on in your brain. There's multiple people doing, suffering with it, you know?
As we know, I think men find it a lot harder to speak out about their mental health. When you have opened up to your friends, have you found that, you know, they've opened up to you as well, and it's become more of a conversation rather than you telling them and them listening?
I think having the circle of friends that I do, which is very small but very family orientated, like the people that I keep counsel with, or the people that I keep close to me, I know most of what's going on in those guys' lives. Because I don't have loads of time, and I don't have loads of people that I call close friends. I have a lot of acquaintances, and what I realized as I got older is, like, I have a small group of friends and a lot of acquaintances. Like, I can walk into like a well-known space in London and say hello to 500 tables of people, but I won't class them now as necessarily my friends. I'll just be like, I know these people. Oh, I just know them. You know, it's not so much that desire to be popular anymore or like any of that stuff. So I think what I'm able to do is give my energy and my love to my close friends. And then I know if they're going through a bad patch, if they're going through a good patch, where they're at. And I think I work on all my friendships. I work on all my relationships, whether it's my relationship with my partner, whether it's my relationship with my mom and dad, whether it's relationships with my close friends, whether it's my relationship with the bank. I work on all these relationships, you know? So it's like, I do feel like I know what's going on, and I think none of us are scared to openly admit when we're going through a rough day. And one of my best friends is you know, he's my height, and I guess no one can see me, but I'm tall. And he's he's a tall bloke, 17 stone maybe. And yeah, we're both fairly big blokes, but you know, we both openly admit that we have down days to each other. We'll converse, you know, with each other's partners. We'll converse as a four. We'll converse, you know. And I think that a lot of us, I think it helps. I can pick up the phone, and that no one's gonna, I know that people love me at the other end of the phone unconditionally, and I know that no one's gonna resent me for calling them, and I know no one's gonna think of me any less because I've opened up, you know, because I'm there for them, and they know I'm at the other end of the phone if they're ever going through something. You know, one of my friends turned up at my house the other day and was just like, you know, there's something wrong. I can tell you haven't been over for the football. There's something wrong. What's going on? So to have those people around me, or you, is very important, I believe. I say something I say a lot, and people probably get annoyed with it, but I think something I've learned is you really are a byproduct of like the five closest people that you keep a counsel with. It's really, really, really important to really evaluate who you have around you, and if it's for the right or the wrong reasons, and who's bringing what to the table, and are you inspired by your friends, or are they dragging you down? Because I see so many people who are just able and willing to let people around them stifle their creativity or stifle their dreams or stifle what they want to achieve because it doesn't suit them. And I think that's one of the biggest problems that we have in society, is that we're enabled to be not complacent, but just to be very like, to live a mundane life. you know, and I think there's probably thousands of people out there who could achieve far more than what they're doing. And the problem is they surround themselves with people who won't drive them or who are content to not achieve their goals or to not change their lifestyle. You know, I spoke to someone online one time and I was like, what are you doing for work? And they were like, I do this, but I'd love to work in fashion PR. And they started the conversation off by saying how hungover they were. And they were like, I would love to work in fashion. I was like, why aren't you doing it? And they were like, well, you know, like I've sent an email here and there. And I said, how about this? I said, how about for the next 6 weeks, you spend from Friday to Monday without any of your peoples around you. You sit at home, you work on yourself, you structure an attack plan and you make it happen. And I said, I guarantee you within 6 weeks, you'll have a job in fashion PR. But people won't sacrifice those weekends. They'll work a job Monday through Friday that they hate and they won't make a small sacrifice to achieve what they want to achieve for a long-term happiness. And there's countless stories of it, you know? So if someone around you is not necessarily financially, but if someone around you is not supporting your ambition or they're not driving you or they're not inspiring you, I don't think it's fair to do that to yourself.
It's a really good point, actually, and I can absolutely relate. Other than, you know, making sure that you are open and talk about the times that you're having, you know, down days and making sure that you keep your friends and your family close, what would you say you do or helps you when you're in a bout of depression? I mean, do you find it easy or hard to be kind to yourself, or is it kind of one of those things when you get into that state and you sort of beat yourself up and you kind of, as you know, as you were saying, you know, why am I feeling like this kind of thing? What do you do that kind of can help?
Run.
I hate running. I'm not going to lie. I hate it.
I just run. I know that if I run, I can't ignore those positive endorphins.
That's true.
So if I'm going through something, or if I sent an awkward text, or if I'm anxious about something, I go for a run. And I really hope they replied by the time I get home. It's one of those things I've just found. It's just like a way of tricking my brain into like snapping out of it. You know, running is, it's again, to touch on Tyson Fury, you know, it really is like one of the best things you can do for your mental health is just release those natural endorphins, you know. You could do a dance class. You could do like, you know, a lot of people I think find solace in like doing yoga and doing like, you know, just or TRX or CrossFit or whatever it is. I like to believe there's always some sort of exercise for someone.
Miles, what are some of the most memorable tattoos that you have given?
There was a Christmas day in New York. This is back when I still used to drink. I was probably north of 10 alcoholic drinks. I think we'd started drinking the Baileys, you know, it got to that time. Oh, I have a Baileys. It's not really alcohol. I just have Baileys, you know, like and my phone's going off. Hey, like group of us want to get tattooed right now. And I'm like, it's fucking Christmas day. Like you're mad. So anyway, they've been like, come. I'm like, I don't really know who this is. It's just like, I don't even know who's hassling me. And I've got a set of keys to this tattoo shop, right? If you want to come and get tattooed, pull up and I'll do it. Whatever. I'm drunk. Like, I'll be honest. And they were like, yeah, we're dry. It's cool. And it's maybe less about the tattoo in this instance, but more just a funny story. But we got to the tattoo shop, these big escalades pull up, all these people get out, come into the shop. And one of them's there. And she said, we have these like bar stools, high stools, right? And I'm tattooing this, my girlfriend's going to love this, but I was tattooing this like Brazilian sort of like swimwear supermodel type girl. And having a great time doing it, you know, we're having a massive laugh. And then all of a sudden, one of the girls who sat on these high stools just hits the deck, just like falls off this stool, drops. And I'm like, oh, fucking hell, this bird's like hammered. Anyway, it turns out, like later down the line, it turns out it's Hailey Bieber. So, show that was a funny one.
That is cool.
There's so many stories. You know, Machine Gun Kelly is another funny one. I was on my way to the football to go down and watch my football team play and my phone rings, American number. And I'm like, so I answer the phone. I'm like, yo, what's up? He's like, yo, it's MGK. I want to get tattooed right now. All right. I never met him. So I was like, all right, where are you? And he was like, I'm at Kentish Town. I'm playing a show here. Can you come through and tattoo me? Like someone show me your shit. Like I want to get a tattoo. I was like, yeah, for sure. Let's do it. And so I've driven over there, got all the stuff set up, met him. Pretty sound guy at this point, pretty chill. And he's there and he's like, I think I want a ship. And I'm like, cool, a ship. So he sits with me side by side, shoulder to shoulder. I'm sitting there and I'm drawing. drawing the ship, tracing it out. We've picked it together. We've watched me draw it. We've like gone through the whole process together. Him and I stand up, made a stencil. Lovely. It's gone on perfectly. I'm like, I am about to fucking smash this tattoo. I'm really confident. I'm about to do a sick tattoo. I'm there and he's like, he's looking in the mirror and he's like, I don't want to ship anymore.
Oh my God.
And I'm like that. Okay. You didn't want to tell me. So I was like that. Okay. So then he sat back down. He sat like, if you looked at it like a football pitch, I'm one goal, he's a center line, and my old assistant's the other goal, right? So like, he can't see my old assistant, right? And so then he goes, just design something for me, bro. And I'm like, I don't know anything about
the
you.
Pressure.
Dude. I'm like, I don't know nothing about this, bro. And he's like, just design something for me, you know? And I'm like, what about a rose? Like a lot of people get roses from me, innit? So I was like, what about a rose? He's like, nope. What about some cherubs? He's like, no. I'm like, that eagle? He's like, got one. Then he goes, oh, yes. He goes, come on, bro. Come on, man. What about something to do with space? He's like, yeah. He's like, I'm always high wandering around. I'm kind of like a spaceman. So let's do an astronaut. And I was like, okay, we'll do an astronaut. And so I've done it again. I sat down, I've fucking done this drawing. And he's like, yeah, I love it. He's like, I don't want any of the shading though, man. Just the lines. And anyone familiar with my work knows that I do a lot of like soft black and gray shaded tattoos. That's how I tattoo, you know, predominantly. And anyway, like he sat there and I've done like kind of outlined some of it. And I'm like, you know what? Fuck it. I'm just going to shade it. So I've just started shading it, you know, against his will. I've just been like, you know, I'm just going to do it my way. Like if you don't like it, fuck it. You know, whatever. What's he going to do? So I started shading it. And, you know, he's smoking his blunt. And he looks down after like 15 minutes and he's like, whoa. He's like, that shit's sick.
Oh, thank God.
He was like, that shit's sick.
Thank God. I didn't know how this story was going to end.
Yeah, he's like, that shit's sick, bro. He's like, you killed this one. And yeah, there's a funny video of him and I on, we made like a little video of the thing and like, he's sitting there, I'm tattooing, and he's smoking, and we got Prodigy playing. And he's like, "Ah, smack my bitch up." it's a funny video, but that was
amazing.
One of the many stories.
Aww. I have really enjoyed speaking to you today, but before you go, one more question. What piece of advice would you give your 21-year-old self?
My 21-year-old self, stop drinking sooner. It's probably like... The best thing I could have said to myself at 21, you know, I didn't stop drinking till I was 27 years old. And then when I did stop drinking, I slowly went through and everything I'd ever wanted to achieve materially, I went through and just one after the next just crossed it off the list because I finally knew or was able to do more with my time from 6 p.m. till midnight. And that's something I never knew what to do with from like 16 years old. I never knew how to pass that time. And the problem was being a tattooer was that every day you work, you get cash in your pocket. So for me, I was finishing work and having a couple hundred bucks, I could always buy a new Stone Island jacket, take a girl to dinner and go on a holiday, right? So it was like within my brain, a massive part of my brain was telling me, go out and achieve, go and do all the things you can do. You're far more creative and you're far more driven than this. But the alcohol just subdued it, just suppressed all all that ambitious side of me just suppressed it because I had this simple thing that I got a bit of money in my pocket. So when I finally stopped, it enabled me that I'd finished tattooing. And like now today, like I've been able to come here and do this, you know, and everything I wanted to do, I was able to do because I had the time to do it. Mm. And I'm not saying that alcohol is a problem for everyone. I'm just saying for me personally, it was debilitating. It slowed me down and it like stopped me achieving, right? So when I stopped doing it, I suddenly found that like I was able to spin more plates and have a clearer vision. And I was able to like learn who I was. So for me, the best thing about not drinking, apart from the achievement side, was that I sat down and over the course of a year, I processed who I was and I learned who I was as a man. And by the end of that process, I said, if people don't like me at the end of this, it's okay because I can look in the mirror and I know I've maintained and I've respected my own integrity. I know I've worked on my relationship with my friends and my family. I know if I see a woman with a pram, I'll help her up the stairs. I know I'll always say please and thank you. And I know I'll always try and do good by people. So if people don't like that, that's okay. I'm not for everyone and that's okay. Mm. But to have that understanding, I would recommend it to anyone in their life to take as much time as it takes to really sit in front of a mirror and to strip yourself down and to understand your strengths and your weaknesses and to address them. Because I think there's something that people in their 60s and their 70s still have never done.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm.
And I think in this physical body or this physical state, we only get one shot at it. And to spend this much time wandering around the earth and in our own brain and to never understand it or to understand who we are, I think you're doing yourself an injustice. So for me, that's like the biggest part of it.
Wow, thank you, Mars. Honestly, some really insightful and goosebumping messages that you just gave. Thank you so much for coming. Honestly, so many great stories and insightful tips. So thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Natalie, I'm sure you can see why I kind of raved about getting my tattoo.
I know, my God. As I said to him, like, oh, I'm now thinking about getting a tattoo myself. Yeah. I mean, wow.
I think even just the conversations, you know, sometimes when you go to get your nails on or something, it's very kind of like base level chat. Mm. But I think with Miles, you will actually talk, he will listen, and you learn about him, he learns about you.
I think he's a really good example as well, you know, and it was really nice to have a man on the show to
for
talk,
sure.
to be open and vulnerable and talk so honestly about the fact that he struggles.
Yeah.
And I think it's a good example that men struggle too, and 100%. To talk about it, you know. Mm.
Yeah, my favorite bit was when he said, you know, for a guy who's over 6 foot and covered
in tattoos, yeah,
if he can't talk about his mental health and his struggles, then
who can?
Yeah,
exactly. It was wonderful to have him. Yeah,
thank you so much for listening to 21 and Over, and a huge thank you to Miles for being our guest today. Please don't forget to subscribe to us wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts to get updated on new episodes. Also, don't forget to follow us on Instagram. We're at 21 and Over with Holly. And if you'd like to send us a note, you can either send us a DM or email us at 21andover@studioramsey.com. We'll see you next time.
Seeking the truth never gets old. Introducing June's Journey, the free-to-play mobile game that will immerse you in a thrilling murder mystery. Join June Parker as she uncovers hidden objects and clues to solve her sister's death in a beautifully illustrated world set in the roaring 20s. With new chapters added every week, the excitement never ends. Download June's Journey now on your Android or iOS device, or play on PC through Facebook Games.